SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Cancria, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith, and unfortunately, this week, Sebastian is not able to join us. Although later I make an allusion to him doing laundry, also likely true. He took a bus, and people breathed on him, and he's now unable to join us this week. Hopefully, he will be rejoining us next week. He also didn't make it to a large signature event this week in Ottawa, in the nation's capital, where the Pride Parade took place. This event was certainly not without its controversy, and we'll be getting into that in just a few moments. But first, I want to tease the fact, and coming up a little later, we have an excellent interview with the producer and host of the true story of Canada's LGBT Purge, Queer Legends Canadian podcast. Incredible documentary, as I say multiple times later in the show, definitely required listening for the queer community. We're also joined by Sarah, an incredible historian, in a lively discussion about how Canada's purge against LGBT folks started as early as the First World War. But before then, a little bit about the Ottawa Pride Parade that recently took place. The parade did happen, just about. There was news story after news story. And I have to say, we attended the Pride Parade as Canqueer and expecting, potentially, to see protest. In speaking with a local business owner in the gay village whilst we were there, she noted to us that the only protest that she saw was corporations boycotting the parade itself. There was no actual protest, no blockade of the parade. It all went relatively smoothly. Although that was almost a hit and miss start. Earlier in the week, we heard that Capital Pride's parade route was actually effectively cut almost in half. Now, many people suspected this was a result of a lot of organizations, including the City of Ottawa and its various departments, pulling out of the parade, the Liberal Party of Canada pulling out of the parade, Carleton University, University of Ottawa, and other major institutions, including local area hospitals, all one by one withdrawing from participating in the parade, effectively shortening its length. However, Capital Pride pointed the finger quite squarely at the Ottawa Police Service for the sudden reduction in policing. Now, for those who are wondering, like, what is this going to do? Typically, for a Pride Parade, almost anywhere in the country, they essentially pay for the time of the police officers. It's typically voluntary. Capital Pride had been working with the Ottawa Police Service for about 6 months on planning for the parade. They were expecting, I believe it was around 20, 25 officers to facilitate the parade route, ensure traffic safety, that kind of thing. However, Ottawa Police revealed only about 6 days prior to the parade happening that they were only able to, it may not have been 6 days, it may have been even less, that they were only able to find a significantly smaller number of officers available, unwilling to participate in the Pride Parade, effectively cutting significantly the ability of the Pride Parade to happen across a larger stretch of time. They had to cut back roads and intersections as the limited availability of the police impacted that. Now, Ottawa Police say that this is due to a significant number of protests and events happening in the city, all of which has worn down the capacity of officers, especially with paid duty events such as this, to be willing to step up. Essentially, with all the protests happening, they're able to spend less time with their family, and therefore just not able to give up that weekend. Others have pointed to Capital Pride's checkered history with the police, including the lively debate a couple of years ago about police participation in general, and especially with their participation in the parade in uniforms. With the city of Ottawa withdrawing, including various departments, as mentioned, of the city, Pride, it seems like they were unable to rustle up enough officers. So Pride points the finger at the police for cutting the route almost in half. Police say it's an issue of being overworked and overstretched. But we also saw significant backlash happening to it. A number of organizations withdrew from participating in the Pride Parade, leading to massive conflict within the community, and conflict here in terms of really demonstrating the fault lines. For example, the Ottawa Hospital issued a statement saying that they will not be participating, essentially pointing to the pro-Palestinian statement issued by Capital Pride and their reaffirming of supporting that community, and saying really that after thoughtful discussion, yada, 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 they have made the difficult decision to withdraw. A number of nursing professionals and medical professions in Ottawa have now come out and issued statements rejecting that position from the Ottawa Hospital. The same rejection of this corporate boycott of Capital Pride was echoed by a large number of queer organizations in the city. It ranges from the Black Gay Men's Network of Ontario, the AIDS Committee of Ottawa, the Ottawa Community Centretown Health Center. We believe that Oxfam Canada came out. The Ottawa Dyke March issued a scathing statement. The Women's Center, the Amethyst Women's Addiction Center, also came out. And really, the list goes on in terms of folks who came out against this boycott. Interestingly enough, when we were there just on this past weekend, the parade was a lot of unions, a lot of churches, which is excellent. A lot of queer organizations there. Hardly any of the queer organizations themselves withdrew from the Pride Parade this year. But really, it was a dearth, a complete lack of corporations attending, with some exceptions. We saw Nokia attending. They have a large employment base in Ottawa. We saw some other large employers, a few different local gyms participated, and CIBC. CIBC was the only bank that participated in Pride. This is notable because the headline sponsor for Capital Pride this year was TD Bank. However, they did not participate in the parade. We will be diving into this a little bit maybe next week as we discuss the fallout and reaction to it. However, we are going to be jumping to our first track and then the interview that I mentioned a little later. We've got a bit of a rock and roll theme with the music this week. We're starting off with Vices by Lonely Little Kitch. And then later on, we'll have Headache by Alana Mari interjecting or sort of breaking up our interview with Queer Legends a little bit. And then finally, at the end of the show, you will hear a Laika of Our Very Own by Greta and the Goldfish. I've been Luke Smith. You'll hear me throughout the interview, and Sebastian will be rejoining us next week. Hello and welcome back to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. Sebastian is doing laundry, I think. Either way, he's indisposed. But I am very excited. I have been listening to this podcast. It has made me cry. There has been joy. And I believe that what we're going to be talking about today should be required listening, not just for the queer community, but for anyone who takes an active history in Canadian, an active history in Canadian interest, either way. I am excited about the two guests that are joining me today. I've got Sean and Sarah on the line. My introduction could do neither of them enough credit. So we'll start off with Sean, the producer and host of The True Story of Canada's LGBT Purge. This is, I believe, season two of your award-winning Queer Legends Canadian podcast. Sean, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on there, Luke. Great introduction. The podcast is something I've been spending the last more than 2 years working on, and so I was really excited to get it launched in this past June 2024. And Sarah, who you'll hear from in a second, is one of the first people I spoke to for this project. And yeah, it's an 8-part series. It was funded in part by the LGBT Purge Fund, which we will talk about in the documentary. And it traces the homophobic policies of the Canadian government and the military and RCMP right from research of First World War, which we'll talk about shortly, right up to, you know, this past May, where they were doing the groundbreaking, thank you. They're breaking the ground for the National Monument in Ottawa. And I've spoken to, you know, dozens and dozens of survivors and, you know, former MPs and so on, even a former chief of defense staff who had some rather, I'll just leave it as, interesting comments about his involvement with the end of the purge in the 1990s. And just to sort of wrap it up, it's 8 episodes, and each episode kind of takes on one decade of the purge from First and Second World War, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, 80s and today, as we say in radio. And it goes right up and explores those things. We break some news. We, in one episode, actually have to adjust the calendar of when we thought the purge actually ended. So a lot of interesting stuff has come out, and it's an emotional roller coaster ride. It was a labor of love, and I'm just glad it's out in the world and that folks can listen to it now. So I'm glad you're interested in it, and I'm happy to talk about it today.
Well, I am a big fan. Sarah, thank you also for joining. I think we're going to get a really good sense of the origins of the groundwork, the foundations. What brought you into this documentary?
Yeah, so I'm a bit of an accidental historian. I started originally working for Veterans Affairs Canada, and unfortunately I had a supervisor at the time that essentially tried to cover up all of the work I had uncovered about the First World War and about queer soldiers during the war. And so I was really impassioned to tell these stories and do whatever I could. And so I also applied for a grant from the Purge Fund. And this was when I was, it was a couple of years ago now, but I was fresh out of my undergrad, very much riddled with imposter syndrome. and they very kindly agreed to take on my research. And so I published a full report that was released in March 2023. It covered 2S LGBTQ plus queer persecution during the First World War. I've since started writing a book on the topic, and I've uncovered more and more stories. And I'm just kind of driven by a duty to make sure that these men aren't forgotten and make sure that their stories aren't covered up.
You know, when we talk about gay news, because as a gay news show, it happens a lot, we are frequently referring to the colonial era war laws. The colonial era, this is a tongue twister, say that 5 times fast. Colonial era laws that got rolled out, not just in Canada, but across, you know, 2/3 of the world with Britain's empire at the time. You know, and a lot of that introduced horrific homophobic laws into many, many countries. So that sort of codification of homophobia. It's a nice crystallization of it. I'm sure to everybody listening, we know that queer folks have long existed. The identity, I think, has been able to be articulated perhaps more recently than in the past. But this documentary series starts in the First World War. Why did you choose that point in time, Sean, and not earlier? Or was that really when, the codification of it sort of seemed to occur?
Well, when I was first looking at it, I mean, the whole class action lawsuit and settlement and everything that came to a head in 2018, 2017, you know, there was sort of a cutoff date for the lawsuit, sort of in, you know, the late 50s. But that's not really when it started, right? The homophobia existed prior to that. I mean, sure, gays and lesbians have been around forever, but so is homophobia, unfortunately. And in doing the research, I thought it was very interesting that Sarah's research was focused on the First World War. And I thought, well, hey, that's a great place to start. And it's also supporting the work of the Purge Fund, which was supporting the series. And it was really interesting, the work that Sarah has uncovered. I mean, when you think about it, we wouldn't even know that these people existed had they not been, you know, victims of homophobia and been thrown in jail and all this other stuff, which Sarah can speak to. But that's kind of why I chose it in that era, because that's, we had the Dominion of Canada. And if you're talking about gross indecency, that was imported thanks to a late night parliamentary debate in 1885 in Britain, where Henry Labouchere snuck in some really nasty queer language that basically made it, because before it was only buggery that really got landed you in prison, you know. And then the Labouchere thing comes, that gets rolled out across the empire, and it landed in Canada, the Dominion of Canada's first, you know, legal framework and what's the word I'm looking for? Criminal code. You know? So yay for that. Thanks, Britain.
Yeah, I'm not going to take credit for that one. I'm going to just move swiftly past. Now, we both mentioned, all three of us have mentioned the Purge Fund. And I think it's worth noting, because I... just taking a quick step back here, we talked a couple of weeks ago about, and I can't remember if it's the States or the UK, where they have introduced a similar fund to compensate victims of the purge that's happening there. You know, it seems like a lovely thing. You know, our government did you wrong. Here's some cash to make you feel better. It sounds like a nice, lovely thing. But I believe, and this is where I'm hoping you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that both the Canadian instance of the Purge Fund and the kind of the echo of that in the States or the UK, I forget which one, really comes out of a class action lawsuit. Like, it's not out of the goodness of their own heart. It was rather a consequence of legal action looking for accountability and some degree of atonement here. Have I misremembered this? Is this where the Purge Fund seems to originate?
Yeah, the Purge Fund came out of the class action lawsuit settlement, and they've got money for, you know, important projects for commemoration and for making sure the Canadians remember. One of the largest and most important aspects of that is the collection of historical documents, and that's what my podcast series and what the documentary is based upon. So I've got all these interviews with folks like Sarah and other experts, but the narrative of the entire 8 episodes is lifted right out of these newly declassified documents. And that whole project is being managed by former MP Sven Robinson. He's been interviewed, of course, for this project. And then, you know, the other big one is the National Monument. But really, it's the documents we're most interested in. Folks should really listen to it, because there's even after the settlement, the LGBT Purge Fund had to be threatening more legal action against the Trudeau government to get more documents. There was such a difficult time for the LGBT Purge Fund and Sven and others who were involved to get documents, and they had to threaten all this action, and then it settled again. There's like a fourth agreement in 2023. And I've done this whole documentary based on what's come out already. There's another 15,000 pages that are still going to come out by 2025. So, you know, episode 2 or like part 2 maybe coming. But I mean, imagine that. Like, I've been able to piece together all this stuff, but like, wait a minute, I still have another 15K worth to go. I'm exhausted already.
And I remember listening to the podcast for the first time, and as like a researcher, that the data itself is very exciting in a way. It's very, because it allows us to almost put to words what we already know has been the case. Because it's easy to say, and I'm experiencing this right now with the project I'm working on. It's easy to say that the discrimination is there. But there's always going to be someone that will say, well, unless you have the documents, unless you're able to prove it, we just can never know. And so I think part of the even pressure, part of the even hesitancy to release those documents really denotes the power and really has kind of these incredible opportunities for us to uncover our history, which is kind of bittersweet, but in the end, as I said, puts towards what so many people in the queer community know to be a reality.
You know, I think there's definitely a degree of risk mitigation that's happening at the government at all levels. You know, they don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want the word to get out that Justin Trudeau's own father may have been, you know, partly involved. You know, like, they don't want to.
Well, he wasn't just partly involved. I mean, he was involved, and we get into that in a couple of the episodes. I mean, nobody should be under any illusion that homosexuality was decriminalized. It was not decriminalized in 1969. It simply relaxed the rules around two consenting adults having intimate relations in the privacy of their own home. If you added if you added one person there, like had a threesome, that's illegal. You could find yourself in jail. You know, that's, he said that, as we'll get into the documentary, like he said, the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. He didn't say the state had no place in the bookshops of the nation and in the bathhouses and the bars and the lesbian bars. And like, that still happened. And in fact, well, we get into in the episode in the 80s, I think, 70s, 80s, I forget exactly what date, but Trudeau specifically allowed homosexual or discrimination based on sexual orientation to continue. Like, he specifically left it out of the Canadian Human Rights Act when he had the option to put it in. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that news, but it's the truth. I mean, sure, like, thank you, Pierre, for what you did, but you could have done a lot more. And, you know, it could have saved a lot of people's lives and pain and hardship and so on. And so the documentary gets into it, into a whole bunch of, you know, nitty gritty detail.
And I mean, even talking about like the bookshops of the nation, Little Sisters, which was one of the biggest legal cases against Canadian Border Security Agency, that was 2000 that it ended, right? Like, this is past even the official, and Sean will talk about this in more detail, but the official ending of the purge, they're still censoring, you know, these books and literature that's being imported into Canada. Yeah, there's fear that that type of censorship could easily resurface. There's actually no, I mean,
Are you being a conspiracy theorist?
No, not to be a conspiracy. I was not going to say that, but not to be
depressing
about it. But there's no protection against that not happening again. Well, there's talk of, you know, wanting to censor books all throughout Canada that we're seeing. In the report that I wrote about Frederick Hardy, one of the only known queer soldiers on the Vimy Memorial, in his hometown, there was pressure from these far-right fascist activists to ban books and ban literature about the queer community. And so this means that, like, kids in his own community wouldn't be allowed to learn about it. And yet at 17, he was able to, you know, be arrested and imprisoned and go through such horrible things. And yet now we're at this kind of standpoint where people are trying to erase this history that we're fighting to uncover.
And they're angry that it's being uncovered. That's the most annoying part. You know, Sarah's done so much work and found so many interesting stories from the First World War. It's really frustrating. You know, like, even the story of how much pushback did you get on the story of Ross Hamilton, one of the most famous Canadian drag performers of the First and Second World War?
Basically, there was a policy, there was a policy at Veterans Affairs when I was working there, that they weren't going to release the stories of queer soldiers from the war, and I guess that extended to the rest of history, unless they had explicit permission from living descendants to do so. And so, you know, it's kind of funny because formal discrimination and the way that we think about it is taboo, but there's these little ways that people will go about it, and they'll call it the bureaucratic process, right? And that was the big, that was the excuse even with the debate with the Purge Fund and the government to get these documents there, saying, oh, it just takes a long time. It just takes a long time, just wait. And you know, that was my experience too. It was like, oh, well, we just have to figure out, if you can figure out this one impossible task for these people who lived 100 years ago, then we can release it, you know? And they've since walked back on those policies after us pressuring them, but it's definitely,
that's an example of the sort of the administrative, you know, homophobia that exists. I spent 12 and a half years in the federal public service in communications working on some of like the craziest headline files in the news. And you still, like, even within the organization, I can tell you the number of access to information requests that I had to review as a communications person was insane. And I'm going through them like a fine tooth comb, you know, there's all these reasons and pressures within departments to try and to either suppress or delay the release, or try to find, like, and we get into this in the documentary with all of these other purge-related documents, is, you know, they're literally trying to put the people asking for the information through bureaucratic flaming hoops, and they'll try and block anything. And as a couple of my guests explained, it's not so much about protecting state secrets as it is about protecting from embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And things. I mean, there's a couple doozies that I uncovered in this thing, you know, like, it was a security guard apparently having an affair with an MP or a senior public servant. And they wanted, like, there's still 1950s era documents, like 1950s, 60s, that have entire page after page after page just all grayed out in a big gray square. You know, like, what, excuse me, what could possibly be so state secret worthy from the 1950s after everything else I've already read? Yeah. You're not going to let me see that juicy bit that's obviously the one I want to see.
Yeah. And like, that was the big concern. That was the justification for the whole policy that was given to me by my manager, was, well, we just can't have any relatives being upset. Like, the risk of upsetting homophobes was prioritized over, you know, queer people seeing our history represented.
Yeah, it was more important than the legacy of this soldier. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Oh, no, exactly. And like, yeah, exactly. So, and more important than honoring these soldiers, which for me as a public servant at the time, I was like, is that not why we're here? Is that not the whole goal?
Ding, ding.
It